Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, David, Jay, and Vicki will sit down with Dr. Greg Renfro, Extension Professor of Meat Sciences at University of Kentucky. And as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. What are y'all laughing about?
What about it, Jay? We're glad you're here.
We are.
I'm glad to be here. If this mic goes dead, you know, while we're recording, just call ambulance and carry on. Show them this thing on my wrist, and right. we'll be good.
That's right.
Everybody have a good trip up this morning?
We did.
Uneventful?
Yeah. Other than the semi in the middle of the median that we can't figure out why he was even there, could we, David?
No, I really wouldn't. You know, we are over here in the kind of the eastern time zone, so you never know exactly what you're going to get into.
That's true.
That was deep into the central time zone. Maybe that's where the driver was from.
He's coming that away, so, you know, what can I tell you?
I'm glad it was wet because by the time he drove that conventional semi, you know, 4 foot into the mud, it kept him from crossing the road into the
active
lane.
Yeah. So that's right.
Always a good thing. So. Yep. Y'all had a good view when you dropped off at that hill there at E-Town. Y'all got to go through my knobs.
We did.
Glad I live in the flatlands is all I'm going to tell you.
I miss them. I'll be honest.
I know you do.
With us today, Dr. Greg Renfro. Yep. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are y'all?
We're good.
See, I got that Kentucky y'all in there.
I'm just getting ready to say I'm impressed.
You know, we give a lot of things out right at the border, right as people cross and come in. And that y'all is the first thing you typically see people pick up.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny when I go back home to Illinois, they say, well, you really picked up that Kentucky accent. And I'm over here and they say, you don't sound like you're from around here. I have no idea what I sound like anymore.
So. Just remember there's y'all.
Yeah.
And then all y'all, which is plural.
That's right. That's all y'all.
That's
exactly.
That's right.
We're glad to have you with us today. Why don't you start off, just talk a little bit about yourself and your background and how you came to Kentucky.
You bet. Born and raised in Illinois. My father is now a retired ag teacher, so oddly enough, I get around ag teachers now, and even though now I'm older than a lot of the ag teachers, I still revert back to my seven-year-old self, you know, because I grew up around those guys. But like I said, born and raised in Illinois, you know, did the typical stuff that farm kids did, you know, 4-H, FFA, and I was about 17 years old, and 16, 17 years old, my dad told me, he said, you need to do something that doesn't involve walking beans, roguing wheat, or detasseling corn. And so I went to work for a local grocery store back when they actually bagged your groceries in paper bags. My students think that's fascinating. Mm-hmm. But
remember it well.
Exactly.
We had one of those in Dixon, actually.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
I know it.
Yeah, and it's funny because nowadays you're like, okay, don't put heavy stuff on my bread. but no, it wasn't long. I was there, and a gentleman that had my dad as a student, he said, hey, I need help in the meat department. Would you come help me? And it was only supposed to be an after-school job, and somehow it ended up as a career. Did my bachelor's and master's at the University of Illinois, and then they shipped me west, University of Missouri, and that's where I earned my PhD there and did some extension work when I was there at Mizzou as well. And it was really interesting. I came here in, I think it was October, into October, and I interviewed. And I actually interviewed against the guy who was the best man at my wedding and the guy who was sitting in the desk next to me at Mizzou. I interviewed against those two guys. And I was finishing the corrections and edits on my dissertation. And lo and behold, I defended my dissertation. As walking out of my office, so we were going to go celebrate, and it was Dr. Bob Harmon, who was the chair at that time here at UK, saying, you want the job? And I said, absolutely. So I've been here 17 years.
Great. Awesome. We're glad to have you.
We're glad to have you.
Good to be here.
Doesn't seem that long, really. But
it doesn't
It does. You know, a while back, I got called senior faculty. I'm like, when did that happen?
It happens quicker than you think.
It does.
Well, you mentioned off air about being a big St. Louis Cardinals
yes.
fan, and I guess that's probably Central Illinois then, Central to Southern.
Yeah, that was, you know, and it's interesting you bring that up because where I grew up in Central Illinois, it was fun because there was a mixture of Cardinal and Cub fans. You know, mm-hmm. if you got north of Champaign, it was all Cub fans. You got yeah. south of Effingham, it was all Cardinal fans. But I grew up in that area there between Champaign and Effingham, actually about a half hour, 45 minutes north of Effingham. And that was a mixture of Cardinal and Cub fans. And, you know, I probably seen more fights over who's better, the Cardinals or the Cubs, you know, than I care to admit. But I think we all know it's the Cardinals.
Yeah.
So, I was fixing to say, they hadn't had a whole lot to be a fighting about. Much,
yeah, really. Yeah, yeah. You know, when the Cubs won the World Series, you could just feel the world would spun a little bit.
Yeah, right.
It was wobbling, you know.
Right.
No, I remember that night well. I had a cousin that lived in Chicago at the time and yeah. was a big Cubs fan. And I texted her. I said, "Hey, you," and she responded, "Don't start." I said, "Actually, congratulations. It's your time."
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, a blind hog finds an acorn every once in a while.
That's exactly right. Well,
you could take put Louisville Cardinal and UK fan,
yes.
and you have the same conversation.
That's
right.
I was actually
yeah,
thinking that as you were talking, yep. and how it felt so weird, kind of like this NCAA tournament this
oh,
year.
Oh, goodness
yeah.
gracious.
You know, it's kind of like that.
Yeah.
I remember the signs back years ago when Louisville had won a national championship in basketball. It said number one in the country, yeah. number two in the state.
That's right. That's right. There you go.
Well, yeah. you've been here 17 years, and
yep.
that's a good long time. You've had a lot of time to develop a program. So why don't
yeah.
you just start, tell us a little bit about your program and,
yeah, absolutely.
And all it encompasses.
Yeah, I actually have an 80% extension, 20% teaching appointment. And I teach a class. It's called ASC 300. Oddly enough, one of my predecessors, Dr. Jim Kemp, who's passed away a few years ago, God rest his soul there, he wrote this book and it was about the history of the Department of Animal Food mm. Science. And I discovered that the class that I teach originally got taught in 1919. And so we've been
wow.
teaching
wow.
that
wow.
class for over 100 years. And mm. it is essentially what it is. It's called meat science. I teach kids how to slaughter animals and cut them up. And it's really interesting, or at least I don't think it's interesting because I'm around it all the time, but my meat processors and the other farmers think it's interesting. I cap my class at 40 kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so I average around 35 to 40 students a semester. A big class of boys for me is around 10 to 12 boys. So the rest are all girls.
Really? Mm-hmm.
And they're like, you teach people how to slaughter and cut things up? I said, yeah, mm-hmm. and it's all girls. And the next question is, okay, what type of girl takes your class?
You know?
Right. And they're envisioning the redneck tomboy type girl. And, yeah, yeah, there's some of those. But, you know, I say this often in recruiting. You know, one year I had a young lady who was a model. I don't mean like Kate Upton type stuff. Just mm-hmm. she did like a lot of local fashion catalogs and mm-hmm. stuff like that. I had a volleyball player, UK volleyball player, one year. And, you see those people on TV, those girls mm-hmm. on TV. I think Morgan was 6'3".
Oh.
They're tall, mm-hmm. tall girls. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Now, the exact opposite. I've had three UK cheerleaders, and they're not tall.
No.
They're not tall. One of them, and we could talk about her later on because she's a fascinating one. One of them stayed on with me and got her master's with me. And probably one of the one I remember a lot is you'll find out when you take my class that before class starts, before lecture starts, I play music videos. The key is you have to listen to my music. And
right.
you probably look at me and don't realize I like hard rock, heavy metal. And this one young lady in the class, she goes, you know, we're about a month and a half into class, and she says, I see you like hard rock and heavy metal. I said, yeah, I love stuff. And she goes, you like Papa Roach? And I said, yeah. And she goes, well, that's my uncle. I'm like, what? Yeah, Jacoby Shattuck is my uncle, who's the lead singer for Papa Roach. So I've had a chance to meet him a couple of times.
Yeah.
Terrific, terrific guy. Would not, you know, I put him in there for that Keanu Reeves, you know, the guy mm-hmm. that just knows what it means to be a celebrity. And, you know, of course, I had to ask her, I said, how does somebody from Folsom, California, end up in Kentucky? Mm-hmm. Horses.
Yeah, of course. Horses. Yep. Yes.
So that's the class I teach. Extension programming, the big one I have is our meat cutting school. We've been doing that, ever since I got here 17 years ago. And I, you know, the dean asked me one time, how many people have you trained? And I said, it's got to be 1,000 people. Because we've trained, we had a large grocery store in the state. We trained about 500 of their cutters, and like this year, I've got 2 beef classes, beef workshops. They're all hands on. Those are sold out. Pork one's close to being sold out. And so the meat cutting school we have is the big one. And the other big one I have is the 4-H Country Ham Project, which we're close to 1,100 4-Hers registered for that contest, for that
It is
program.
Phenomenal. If you have not been to the state fair and walk through when they have that contest, I mean, all of those country reps, like, oh, my word.
Yeah, we had a meeting, the ham committee and myself, we had a meeting yesterday to talk about, man, that's a lot of speeches, because that's one aspect of the program is that they have to give a speech at the state fair. And mm-hmm. we're talking about, you know, because we went from like 825 to 1,100.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And, and it was just, it's amazing. It's great. It's cool to have those kind of those growing pains in that program, but we got to figure out how we're going to do this too.
Yeah, and it takes so many volunteers, and there's a ton of folks that do volunteer, it still takes a ton of volunteers. Yeah. You're talking about judges, you're talking about people that are there at the door to get people in and out, and
absolutely,
then all of that.
Yeah.
And that's not talking about the ham judging or any of that stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, that's right. just the speeches.
Yeah,
you know?
It's about 125, 130 people. Mm-hmm. So if you're listening, you want to volunteer.
we're taking it.
We'll
we're
take
you.
It.
Yeah.
So,
that's really interesting. And, talk with us a little bit. And, of course, today we're here to talk a little bit about, some home processing mm-hmm. and the popularity of that. Talk a little bit about how that's gained so much popularity and why it's gained so much popularity in the last couple of years.
It definitely has, all sorts of home processing, even not only meats, but you talk to some of the FCS agents and they'll tell you, there's a big interest in home canning as mm-hmm. well. And it's kind of like what's old is new again, I guess is the best way to put it.
I like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And more folks are, what I think is fascinating as a meat scientist, as an animal scientist, a food scientist as well, is that there's more interest in food, And when I started cutting meat, like I said, in the late 80s, just dated myself there. I started cutting meat in the late 80s. You just went in and it was beef, pork, chicken. Mm-hmm. And now you've got beef and then you've got some branded beef program, whether it's certified Angus beef or private selection Angus or whatnot. You have that. And then you have grass finished organic. Mm-hmm. And so there's more opportunity for consumers, if they're really interested in that, they can purchase that. And so there's more interest in it. And then, you get more and more people that are just solely interested in doing things themselves. One of the things I didn't mention, this spring we've got a processed meats clinic. And one of them, mm-hmm. we're doing two of them, doing one for meat processors and one for extension agents. And the main reason why we're doing the one for extension agents is because more and more extension, agents are getting the question, how do I make sausage? I go deer hunting, I want to turn that into a sausage. And so we got to kind of get in front of that so that, the agents can teach those individuals how to do it safely, number one. And number two, they have to understand that we cannot legally sell this stuff,
Right.
Yeah. So we got to get in front of that kind of stuff. But it is, like you're saying, it's just simply people are more interested in food. They really are. They want to know where their food comes from. That's why the Kentucky Proud program is so huge. And when I go to conferences, people ask me about our Kentucky Proud program.
I think that direction started a good while ago.
Absolutely, yeah.
But when we went through the COVID year in 20, that just kick-started it. I mean, that was an on-ramp to a lot higher introduction of those type of activities to be done at home.
Yeah, absolutely. It did. It forced us to number one, it kind of exposed a little bit of an Achilles tendon in our industry because – You know, we have, for the last 60-some-odd years, have taught farmers management techniques and feeding programs to make these animals grow faster, because we have 9 billion people we've got to feed in the next 25, 50 years. And so we created a NASCAR, if you will, something that is fast. And then all of a sudden, we worked with the major meat processors in the country, and they became the NASCAR pit crew because they could get them in and out quick. And then all of a sudden, you take one aspect of that out, and we saw things that I think none of us would ever think is seeing. You know, we're used to seeing limits on sale items, but these weren't sale items. Mm-hmm. We legitimately, mm-hmm. you know, only take 2 beef items, only take 2 mm-hmm. pork items, and so on and so forth. Because, you know, even though we had a stockpile of beef and pork, boy, we can mill through that pretty quick. And that's, mm-hmm. you're absolutely right. The pandemic years, and thank goodness, I do think we're over it. I went to the doctor's office last week, and I didn't have to wear a mask, which was kind of cool.
I noticed that myself.
Yeah,
week.
And so I would, you know, even though they haven't officially said we're done, you know, I do think when you see doctors' offices and hospitals doing that, we're okay. But it did kind of force us to return to what our grandparents did, you mm-hmm. know, canned fruits and vegetables, grow our own fruits and vegetables. I guess during, was it World War II, they called them victory gardens, you know, right. those type of things. Yeah. So there is that return to, you know, doing it yourself.
Yeah. You mentioned what's old is new again.
Yeah.
I can remember in my career, I guess I've worked the longest of the three of us, in an office anyway.
Yeah.
I can remember the old USDA publications, and some of those that were the most useful still, even though they were far outdated, was the animal slaughter publications. There were ones on slaughtering sheep and on processing hams and putting up hogs.
Yeah. Those old publications. I've got one. I've got it stuffed in a filing cabinet in my office. It was actually wrote by George Washington Carver. So that tells you how it's just kind of a cool thing to have something that George Washington mm-hmm. Carver published. But I get that a lot of it can, and that's part of the reason why the processing classes have taken off and are so popular. Mm-hmm. People want to learn how to do that, you know, whether it's a COVID thing or just something they want to know how to do. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because during that time of the pandemic, a really good friend of mine and colleague of mine up at Ohio State University, she said, "Well, you've done all these cutting videos. Why haven't you ever done a slaughter one?" And it's like, well, it's kind of a sensitive subject, you mm-hmm. know. And she goes, "Well, I'm thinking about doing one." And she was able to do it. She was able mm-hmm. to do it. And I think I talked to her earlier this week, and oddly enough, that came up. And she said, "Yeah, it gets a lot of views. It really mm-hmm. does, because people want to see it, you know." And in her state, they've got these guys called the Bearded Butchers, you know. And
I've seen them.
Yeah, I've
seen them.
I tell you what, they rock the beard like the Duck Dynasty guys do. They're almost like, you know, the ZZ Top of meat cutters right there.
Yeah, they make that look really easy too.
They make it, yeah,
and fast.
And fast. That's right.
Yeah, I had a student one time. She looked at me and she says, "You make it look so easy." And I said, "I've been doing this for 35 years. If I can't make it look easy, somebody else needs to be teaching you."
That's right.
But yeah, it's amazing, you know. And it's funny because the paradigm has shifted. Like you said, those old extension publications, mm-hmm. they're still extremely valuable. Mm-hmm. But we also have a population out there, and not to pick on them, but the publication is not what they're looking for. They're going to YouTube, you know, mm-hmm. and I'm sure everybody is, you know, if you're an extension, you've had these conversations. I always know it's going to be a fun conversation on the phone when it starts out with, "I was reading on the internet that,"
mm-hmm.
"I saw on Facebook that," or "I saw this thing on YouTube," you know. So I always know it's going to be a fun conversation there you know, from that point forward.
Oh, I know. You know, and I saw things that, like you were talking about, I mean, I saw there wasn't any ground beef.
Yeah,
you know, at the grocery store, and you know, when I started seeing that, I thought, I'm gonna have to do something to, you know, to be able to feed my family, because you know how bad things are going to get. So we actually slaughtered 2 pigs.
Yeah.
We grew them out, mm-hmm. and you know, we got them in like May or whatever, and we slaughtered them in November, and I actually looked on YouTube to you know, and they had some pretty decent. The Bearded Butchers were mm-hmm. one of them that I looked at, that they actually showed you how to process that pig. And, you know, I hired a guy to come and do all the slaughter and everything and the gutting. And then we processed the pig. And, I mean, we rolled right through that, and we're done by lunch. Had 2 of them, and we had 4 or 5 family members, and we all got around and did that. And, you know, it was a good time. But, you know, it was something that I'm glad I did, because if I have to do it again, I think I can. You know, one of those kind of deals.
Yeah. Did you scald them?
No, we did not. We skinned them.
Skinned them.
I think, too, part of the what's driving that is the local people, even if they do not want to do it themselves, they want to know where it came from. They want to know who did that, who raised that hog, who raised that cow, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And because it's more of that supporting local, and that local drive is part of that that's pushing some of this, too, as well. But, you know, it's encouraging to me when you say how many people's in your classes and things like that, because you feel like it is a lost art. When you start going to some of these small towns like mine in Dixon, Kentucky, that is a small town, David. And
not much there.
But we had a grocery store there that was locally owned for years. And the amount of meat that he, you know, he butchered for people was tremendous. And they came from miles and miles away, and you would see them going out of this little grocery store with a cart full of nothing but just meat that they came to get.
Yeah.
And, you know, they retired, and that's no longer happening there anymore.
Yeah.
And when you grow up in a community with those little mom-and-pop type stores, and you're used to going there and getting all the meat you ever want, then they're no longer there. Then you've got all these people, well, where are we going to go now?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that has pushed that, you know, wanting to either do it yourself or, you know, buying it local, which has also helped those farmers markets. You know, I work with the farmers market in Webster County, and, you know, the pandemic really, you know, our customer base shot up.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and a lot of it because it was available there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the other part was they felt like it was safe. They knew, you know, they knew where it came from, and they stay with us.
Yeah. How many people have gone into feeding out their own cattle and getting it processed and selling their own meat? What I mean, what percent increase has that been since all this started?
Yeah, I don't know the actual number on that or statistic on that, but it is, you're absolutely right. We do a lot of discussing, you know, an extension program. In fact, I've got one this Saturday at Kentucky State University over the exact subject of people, how do we do this? And, you know, how do I do it legally? And
right.
And we take them down the avenues of, okay, you can do the freezer beef or the freezer pork, where you know, halves, quarters, wholes, or whatever. How do we do that? And then we talk about the farmers markets, and then you get into the more advanced, you know, of can I supply a restaurant? Probably not. Can I supply Kroger? Definitely not. You know,
right.
So we talk about those kind of things, but you know, it used to be 17 years ago when I got here, we would talk about farmers markets, and that was just a Lexington, Louisville, Covington type thing, you know. And now you see them at the county extension offices have farmers markets. You see them in the small towns as well, you know. And that's the one thing that I always stress to our farmers, our beef farmers and our pork farmers that are going to be direct marketing their product is, you know, most of the people are – they're buying your product, yes, but they're buying your story, like you were talking about. That's what they want to know. They want to be sitting around at a dinner party and be able to say, you know, this came from this farmer, and this farm has been in the family for 100 years, and their kids are involved in 4-H, their kids are involved in FFA and things like that. That's what people want. They want the story. They're buying your story. The meat just comes with it, you know. And it's become I hesitate to use the phrase dinner theater, but it kind of is that a way, because those that are having the dinner parties, the holiday parties, they want to be able to talk about that.
And the other thing, too, I would encourage those folks that are getting into that direct market on the meat side is – reach out and get involved in your farmer's market. And it may take a little bit before you're going to see a lot of people buying, because if you're new, people are going to buy from you. But the more they see you there, then before you know it, you're going to have regulars. And then that market season is going to be over. So it's a short, you know, it's a time frame. But guess what? Those same customers are going to call you and buy their meat through the winter too.
Yeah.
And so you can really advance your sales if that's what you're wanting to do. By, you know, that farmer's market can be a stepping stone for you to do that, and it helps you, and it helps the community, and it helps the other vendors there, because it brings variety to the market.
Yeah, it's one thing that I learned when I was working retail grocery is anybody can sell something. That's easy. the true art is getting them to come back, mm-hmm. you know, and that's what exactly mm-hmm. what you're talking about. If you can get them to come back, you're successful.
That I happened to be listening to another podcast from some folks out west that were actually putting in a plant. Mm-hmm. The guest was putting in a yeah. slaughter facility. And that was the big thing that he was talking about is the story that goes along with that meat. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's what keeps people coming back. That's what, you know, them knowing that, you know, you're the sixth generation that's been on that ranch or farm and, you know, being able to tell that story and about how those cattle were treated or pigs were treated, that kind of thing. Yeah. So it was, that was their big, mm-hmm. you know, it was his drive home point was that it had to, it really needs to have a story.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about sure. if a person is, they're not wanting to, you know, process them themselves, anything like that. They, you know, they just don't want to do that for whatever reason, but they do want to buy say a quarter or a yeah. half or something yeah. from a local person, mm-hmm. you know, and, but talk just a little bit about if you've never done that before, what expectations you should have, because absolutely. Sometimes yeah. what you think it's going to be may not be exactly the way it is. And then from even pricing, kind of how it's priced yeah. to how much meat to expect and freezer mm-hmm. space and all
yeah.
of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It is, it's really interesting when you bring that up because from a seller standpoint, all right, most of our farmers are used to just getting them to weaning and then selling them off. Mm-hmm. And used to be, I used to joke, and it wasn't really a joke, but it was actually a thing where about once a month I get a phone call. I took a 1,200-pound steer in. I came home with 350 pounds of meat. Somebody's stealing stuff off of me. You know, and then we go through the numbers, and you could see how those numbers dive down really quickly. And so we've kind of jumped that hurdle in some respects. But we also have the individuals that, okay, they call up, whatever homemaker it is. You know, they call up a farmer and say, hey, can I get a side of beef from you? And they said, well, you know, the problem of it is there's another side.
Yeah, exactly.
Or I want a quarter. Well, there's another, you know, three quarters of the animal. Yeah. And so what we've seen folks have some success with is what we call a beef share or a pork share, where those individuals will kind of like a racehorse where, you know, several people own a racehorse. You know, mm-hmm. it's kind of the same thing where people get together and they buy a whole carcass. And then I've even heard it turn into like a party to where, you know, pour a glass of wine, beer, bourbon, whatever, because it still is Kentucky with the bourbon. Mm-hmm. But then they sort it out there because somebody may want more ground beef than somebody else. Mm-hmm. Somebody may want more roast and so on. And so that beef shares type thing is become a popular thing for folks to do because most of us, you know, especially nowadays, they don't, you know, like when I grew up, we had a deep freeze. It was down in the basement. You know, we could load that dude up. Most people, the freezers is above the refrigerator, and so they can't yeah. handle a side of beef, a quarter of beef, you know, and so that's where that beef share comes into play. But one thing that folks have got to realize is that farmer or that meat processor is going to sell you the hanging weight, mm-hmm. and so that hanging weight may be 400, 500, 600, 700 pounds, or even 800 pounds if it's a fully finished animal. And so that doesn't mean you're going to take home 600, 700, 800 pounds of meat. You're probably going to take home about, you know, if it's an 800-pound side, you're probably going to take home about, you know, 40% of that or 50%. About, you know, 400 pounds of it or 50% is going to be retail cuts, and then you're going to get a bunch of ground beef, you know. Mm-hmm. Yep. And so folks have got to understand that, you know, just because you're buying a side of beef and it's a 700-pound side of beef, and you're buying it for, I don't know, $2 a pound. I'm just throwing that number out there, that you're not going to bring home 700 right. pounds of meat. Yep. So they need to yep. understand that. And that's where the communication between the farmer, the meat processor and the farmer, the consumer, the farmer and meat processor, those communications have to happen there. And the other thing that we've come across is chances are it's going to look like what you have in a grocery store, but it's not going to be exactly what you're going to see in the grocery store. You got to realize grocery store meats coming in, those cattle are coming in, live weights are around 1,500 to 1,600 pounds. your farmers are not going to do that. You know, 1,200 pounds, 1,100 pound live weight is about all you're going to get. So the muscles are going to be smaller. And it's the same with pigs. You know, Dr. Lindemann and I, we got done with some research a few years ago. We took pigs up to 350 pounds, which is about 50 to 60 pounds heavier than what you see now. And the reason being is the pig industry is going the exact direction of the beef industry as the poultry industry has gone as well. Animals gotten bigger.
Yeah.
And so we had to do that research to see, you know, what's going to be, you know, what's going to happen. And so folks have got to understand that, you know, it's not going to look exactly like what you see in the grocery store. And the other thing is the whole wet age versus dry aging of beef. You know, everything you get in a grocery store is wet aged because, you know, IBP is going to be slaughtering cattle at 400 to 500 head an hour. They're doing that 16 hours a day, 5-6 days a week. You know, your local meat processor is probably doing 10 a day. They're aging it inside their cooler. They're dry aging it. And that's a little bit different flavor than the wet age stuff that's in the vacuum bag that's in the box that goes to your grocery store. Now, can we have a long discussion that people are going to over-season the meat and take those little subtle flavor nuances out of it? Absolutely. That's another topic for another time. But just be aware that that's going to happen. It really is.
We may have to do another show to talk about that right there.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah. A good idea.
But just real quickly, just because we get these questions, you know, and I know it's going to depend a whole lot on the size of that slaughter animal, but just a comparison, if somebody's thinking about that, you know, let's just say if you're looking at a quarter of beef, you know, when they're thinking about how much freezer space do I need to have? Do I have enough? You know, how do you go about figuring out how much freezer space you need? Roughly.
I think you're really testing me on this one. I think it's the rule of thumb is about 20 to 25 pounds per cubic foot is what you can handle. Yeah.
Because that's always a question. You know, I haven't gotten that in a little while, but I have gotten it over the years several times. But, you know, it is something to think about because I know, you know, a lot of times, sometimes you get the call, you know, because they're like, oh, I got way more meat than, you know, you don't get the, it's usually the other way thinking you're going to get more, but I have gotten them more.
And the other problem that you get into is when farmers or producers are pricing live weight prices on a 1,600 pound steer, you know, and people try to figure out how much meat they're going to have and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, they want to get a good value, there's no doubt. But the producer wants to get his money, too, because it takes a lot to get one that big.
Yeah, it does. And you know, that's something that folks have got to realize. You know, the IBPs, the Cargills, the Smithfields of the world, the big processors, they have economies of scale in their favor. That's why their meat is priced different than local, you know, and a lot of farmers will call up and say, well, how much should I charge? And you know, if they call me up or they, you know, usually I send them to Kenny Burdine, our ag economist, because he's the economist, you know. Yeah. I don't even handle our own checkbook. My wife does that. But and I tell them the one thing Kenny's going to ask you, Dr. Burdine's going to ask you, is what is your break-even price? Mm-hmm. And then there's usually a long pause on the other end. And it's something nobody's thought about. And a good rule of thumb, you know, obviously, you need to know your break-even price on that stuff. But we usually say whatever is you see at Kroger or Meijer or Walmart or IGA, whatever that is, plus 30%. And that's going to get you in the ballpark. And that is a little bit of a sticker shock. And it's funny because some folks are willing to pay a big premium for that ribeye, that strip steak, that T-bone. They may not be willing to pay a big premium for that ground beef, that chuck roast, that round roast. And that's why we've also worked with some of those folks that are doing, you know, if they're doing the farmer's market with direct marketing, is don't sell individual cuts because everybody's going to buy all your good stuff and leave you with the ground beef and the
and roast.
The roast, yeah. And so sell bundles, $50 bundle, $75 mm-hmm. bundle, yeah. and so on.
I think that's really caught on, too, the bundle thing. Yeah.
It has. And, I mean, I think it really works well, too, with families, though, that they don't have the freezer space to put mm-hmm. very much in there. But yeah. you can get that bundle, and you can – that'll work, you know, that may run you for a week or 2 weeks or something like
Absolutely.
That. But I do think that we talk a lot on this podcast is about telling your story, telling your ag story, and sharing that, because that's part of the marketing of anything that you do, anything you do, that is part of it. And I think education is the other key to that,
yeah.
is you do have to kind of let your customers know the cost that you have in this. And this is why, because you're feeding this animal out to this weight so that the meat is where it needs to be. It's got the correct marbling. It has yeah. all that needs to be so that their customer is going to be satisfied with that. But there's a cost to that, and that's the part that I think that we need to make sure that we convey that so they understand that.
Well, what's it worth knowing where your food comes
that's
from?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that you're going to have it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We think back to the pandemic, and, you know, folks
right.
couldn't get it.
Folks couldn't get it.
Yeah.
You called it the Achilles heel. I referred to it as the chink in our armor.
Yeah.
We found the weak spots in yeah. our development.
Yeah, when you have to limit how much chicken you can buy.
Yeah.
I mean, that we've got an issue, you know, in our deal. And hopefully, and Greg, you may expound on this a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, we have added slaughter facilities since yeah. all this has come along. You know, how much has that helped this whole situation?
It has helped us out tremendously. There's about 5 or 6 brand new slaughter facilities, local meat processors out there. We have been able to, you know, through the help of the Ag Development Board and USDA granting agencies, we've been able to increase slaughter. And just this week, I was at a couple of our meat processors, and about 3 of them actually. And those 2-3 year wait lists are now back down to normal. So mm-hmm. they're yeah. coming back down, and which is a good thing, mm-hmm. you know. But the issue we have is, you know, and this is one thing we talked about with the Ag Development Board is, yes, you can put in new facilities. It's a challenge to find people to work in those facilities.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's why, you know, the meat cutting school that we have at UK helps out. You know, mm-hmm. it helps out. You know, but it doesn't fix everything, you know. Right. And it's one of those, it's a chicken and egg type thing, you know. You know, you need the workforce, but you got to have the work to have the workforce, you know, right. those type of things. So those are yeah. conversations that's going on. But, you know, it is neat that we have expanded processing mm-hmm. in the state. And, you know, folks want to know, you know, where does this money go? That's where it went. And we've done some good with it. And I'm pretty proud about that kind of stuff.
For our absolutely. Listeners out there that may not know, I mean, there is some facilities that you might hear that are that's USDA
yep.
facilities. Mm-hmm. And some might say that they're not. And, yeah. and basically, you know, if that's something that you often wonder what that means. If somebody's going to be selling that for sale by the piece or by, you know, yep. like the ground beef yep. or whatever,
absolutely.
That animal has to be slaughtered in a USDA certified kill line.
Yep.
And then
yep.
where if you're going to buy a quarter or a half or whatever, then it does not have to be. So just for our listeners sure. that may not know the difference in those.
Sure, yeah. USDA inspection, that started back in 1906 with the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Act, and part of the Pure Food and Drug Act was the Federal Meat Inspection Act of 1906. And we still operate under the heart and soul of that original document today. Yeah, we've changed it. We've added to it. But, you know, it just simply states, you know, I believe it actually part of it says, any meat intended for interstate commerce has to be inspected by the USDA. It's the government's way of saying we have to look at it before you sell it. You know, so
yeah.
so they're a little bit more poetic than you think they are. And so if you're a farmer and you're interested in this, you do have to have a USDA inspected facility. And one of the things we got to make sure is all areas of the facility are inspected. Like for example, some of our processors that are USDA, only the slaughter portion of it is inspected. And that sounds a little bit odd for folks, but this is how segmented things can get. As if it's USDA inspected on the kill floor, and when that carcass rolls into the cutting room, if that area is not inspected, it loses that inspection mm-hmm. stamp. You know, and so And you say, well, why would somebody do that? Well, some processors will have everything harvested under inspection as a protection. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you never know what kind of animal you're going to get. And they want to make sure that they don't release an animal that has been diseased or wouldn't pass inspection, mm-hmm. or so on and so, mm-hmm. forth. So that's why some of those do that. The flip side of that is if you're a farmer and you just want an animal to put in your freezer, you can go to a custom facility. And a custom facility is simply where you say it's a contract between you and the meat processor, saying that I'm going to slaughter this for you, I'm going to cut it up, I have to stamp everything, not for sale, mm-hmm. all right? And it's for you and your family's consumption. Does that mean if you sell 10 pounds of ground beef to your neighbor, have you broken the law? Yeah, you have. Okay, yeah. Now, is, you know, Dog the Bounty Hunter going to come after you? Probably not, you know. But what ends up happening is, like, we've been talking about farmers markets, and I'll start getting phone calls this summer, somebody mm-hmm. that bought something at a farmers market that was stamped not for sale. Right. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh, my God, and you're not going to die. You're okay.
That's right.
It's just a legal thing.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people used to work around that. The producer would say, you're buying my animal,
yeah.
but you're paying them to process it.
Exactly.
And you write two checks for that animal.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You own the live animal. Yeah,
right.
You own the live animal, mm-hmm. which goes back to what she was talking about with the freezer beef,
right.
the freezer
yep.
pork.
Yeah. Greg, talk with us a little bit. I mean, I know we've talked about beef and pork this mm-hmm. whole time, but there are other animals that are being packaged and sold in the state of Kentucky. I can think about a fellow county agent down in the western part that sells lamb.
Yep.
And then some folks that do chickens too, yep. as well.
Yeah, most of your USDA processors that do livestock can do lamb. You know, whether or not they have that in their HACCP plan, which that's another topic.
Yeah, right.
People listen, it's like, man, we've been going down these avenues, and he stops. But
right.
But HACCP it stands for Hazard Analysis and Critical Control Points. That was it's a food safety program put in by the USDA. So that's, once again, you know, you go through inspection, but those products also go through a HACCP plan as well. And so, you know, they may or may not have a HACCP plan for mm-hmm. lamb, but lamb's one of those that we don't eat a whole lot of lamb in this country. You know, part of the reason is we've kind of lost our taste for lamb, you know, mm-hmm. But we do have a lot of folks in the state that do sell lamb, and they do sell it. And again, that has to be at a USDA facility. The poultry processing, that's one of those things that we are desperately needing in this state, is more poultry processors. We've got one that's getting ready to come online in the eastern part of the state here, hopefully in the next month or so. And so we do need more poultry processors in this state, because you're exactly right. You know, we do eat more than beef and pork, and we mm-hmm. do eat lamb. We do eat poultry, you know, whether it's chicken or turkey or whatnot. Mm-hmm. I mean, turkeys, mm-hmm. you used to be, when I was a kid, turkey was just something you had at Thanksgiving and Christmas. Mm-hmm. You know, now it's, you know, there's probably some people out there have already had turkey twice this week for
yeah.
some meal.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
so.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, it's just another thing of the times are different than they used to be, and it's ever changing. And
well, I talked to a lady that had a small farm, and what they were doing was they were doing the beef, and they were raising pasture pork, and they were doing the whole the poultry deal, the chicken tractors.
Yeah, yeah.
And anyway, there was a place down in either Todd or Christian County that was doing the processing for them. So they would load the chickens up, take them, and they'd mm-hmm. get processed, bring them back, and then they would sell them.
Yeah.
And
it was in Christian County.
Yeah, yeah. And so I thought that was really interesting. I think the folks lived in Princeton, if I'm not mistaken, is where those folks that I were talking to. But anyway, I thought that was real interesting that they were able to take it there.
It amazes me. A lot of county agents will invite me out to do a cutting demonstration where I grab a chunk of beef, and we'd
You came to Webster County one time.
Yeah, and I've gotten amazed where sometimes they'll say, can you teach people how to cut up a chicken?
Yeah.
That's become a lost art as well. For it used to be whatever homemaker it was, that they could cut up a chicken, and nowadays, folks have no idea.
Like a lot of other lost skills, if you didn't have somebody in your family that passed that on to you.
Yeah, exactly.
You know how to do it.
Exactly.
Yep. That's That's right. Well, that leads us into our timely tip. And, Jay, I think you're going to share with us our timely tip.
You know, everything we talk about nowadays has inflation attached to it at some point in time. So, you know, the timely tip for this week is how to manage inflation from a meat production standpoint. That's your price of meat and your price of your inputs.
Yeah, that is inflation is I get a lot of phone calls on that, you know, because the price of everything is going up. It really is. And I've even learned a new phrase called sizeflation, where, you know, people say, I'm in the grocery store and I don't see the price of the product changing that much. And I said, look at the size of the package. Yep. And that's the sizeflation is, you know, as somebody who worked in retail for 14 years, a retail meat cutter, I could tell you, you know, as if this price doesn't change, you're not going to get people complaining. If I make it, you know, and that's why you'll see sometimes, yeah, and one of the meat cutter tricks we used to do when prices go up, we'd start cutting things a little bit thinner to make sure that price doesn't change.
Right. Yep.
But if you look at the price per pound, all that stuff has changed, the size of whatever box of cereal, macaroni and cheese, coffee.
Peanut butter.
What you get at a restaurant.
Yeah, exactly. Which for our waistline is probably good that there's a little bit less on the plate. But yeah, that inflation thing is hitting everybody, and they say, well, how do I save money? And I say, you know, I tell them, all right, number one, you know, buy in bulk. It's a little bit of a sticker shock, but I can buy a whole pork loin, you know, which is only a couple of dollars a pound now, and I can buy that. I can take it up to the counter, and they can cut that up for you, and that's a lot cheaper. Because one of the things that we emphasize to not only our UK students, but these individuals in our meat processing classes, is every time my knife touches that piece of meat, it goes up in price. Mm. And so if, you know, and even if you're comfortable cutting a pork loin up yourself, you know, you can do that at home. I do it all the time, but I'm a little comfortable doing that kind of stuff. Buying family packs and repackaging it, you know, I'm freezing it for later on.
Vacuum sealing.
The
home vacuum sealing.
Oh, yeah.
We do that all the time. We buy a box of chicken.
Absolutely,
And then vacuum seal.
Been doing it for years.
Yeah, we do too.
And don't be afraid to eat leftovers. Seems like a novel idea to eat a leftover, but yeah, that's, you know, those are just little tips that you can utilize of buying in bulk. Yeah, it's a little bit of a sticker shock, but you find out, well, maybe I don't have to go to the grocery every week or every other two or three days or something like that. And the other thing too is the club stores. You know, you can go to club stores and buy this stuff. And yes, it's in bulk, and yes, you have that sticker shock. But again, those individuals behind that meat counter will cut that up for you, and will gladly do it for you. And it's a way of saving money. Yep. And it, you know, maybe it's time, you know, that we do go back to the deep freeze, the family deep freeze that most of us grew up with. You know.
I've got three of them.
I was in my mind. I was thinking, how many do I have in my house?
It was funny. I've got a kind of a picture on one of a few of the slides, my PowerPoint slides I use for extension, and it's the caption of it is the manager at Home Depot speaks fluent redneck, and you got all these four different sizes of freezers, and one says one deer, two deer, three deer. You know, so you can, if you speak fluent redneck with your Home Depot or your Lowe's guy, you could get a freezer big enough to hold what you need. But yeah, just buying in bulk is a great way of saving money.
You're talking about saving money, and earlier you were talking about processing chickens.
Yeah.
Price the difference between a whole chicken versus a bag of legs or a bag of quarters
or
breasts.
Absolutely.
It does not take long at all take apart a chicken.
It doesn't. Yeah. No, it's easy.
Easy.
You could watch YouTube and figure out how to do it. You could come to Dr. Renfro's cutting classes and do that as well. So I encourage folks to do that. I mean, if you have an opportunity to come to one of his classes or something of this nature, you know, you want to be more self-reliant, those kind of things, this is a way to do that.
It never hurts to learn a new skill.
Yeah, Vicki was talking about having him out before. Maybe that's something we need to do as a group, is provide that opportunity for folks to come out.
That'd be great.
You know, a lot of people want to have you out to do deer demonstrations and things like that, and to me it's almost after the fact because they wait till deer season to do them.
Those are always fun to do, and you know, it's funny because my you know, my department chair and our dean is like, you seem like you have your hands in a bunch of stuff. And the odd one that people think is really odd is I work a lot with fish and wildlife.
Right.
And exactly that is, as we do deer cutting videos, fish processing videos, mm-hmm. cutting videos, filleting, you know, that kind of stuff. And I'm also involved in that Cook Wild Kentucky, those sure. recipe yeah. cards you see. And those are always fun to do. I can tell you right now, the recipe we try to develop for the raccoon, the old trash panda was rough. I can tell you that right now. But
you just needed a young one.
Yeah, you needed a young one. Yeah, I don't know how old this one was. It was kind of rough. But you know, those deer ones are always kind of fun because I'm on call then.
Right. Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. You are.
Fish, it's funny because we've had this discussion at some of these trainings, and it's like, you know, well, we're waiting on Fish and Wildlife to get us a deer. They have to get an emergency permit to do that. Just because they're Fish yeah. and Wildlife doesn't mean that they can just run out there and shoot one, you know. But they have to go through the same legal process everybody else does.
Wow.
So it's always interesting when they call me up and says, hey, we need to shoot another deer processing video. And I said, okay, when? And they're like, block this week off. So I can't go. I'm on call to cut up a deer.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds good. Greg, we appreciate you
My
being
pleasure.
Here.
Thanks. This is fun.
We got a chance to sit down and get this done finally. We wanted you to have you on for a while.
Yeah,
so
that's great.
You'll be a retread. I'll just go ahead and tell you that.
Yeah, we're going to get you again.
That's no problem. That's what we're here for. Yeah.
So we want to have a special thanks to Dr. Greg Renfro again today for the Meat Science at University of Kentucky, and thank our hosts for this week's information, and thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.